All right, well, thanks for coming, everybody. This meeting's hosted by the Socialist Party of Great Britain, which is an organisation which exists for the sole purpose of replacing capitalism with socialism, which we define as a system of society where all the productive resources are held in common. Today's meeting is entitled Why Not Utopia? And we have Professor Barbara
Goodwin,
who will be introducing the subject. And we have, from the Socialist Party, we have Pat Deutz. So the two speakers are going to speak for about 20 minutes each, 25 minutes. Then after that time, there'll be a period of questions and answers. And we'll also have a tea break at around 3-ish, when there'll be some refreshments provided. So, ever let Barbara begin?
Okay, thank you. The title I was given was Why Not Utopia? I'm an academic by profession, and as anyone would tell you, there are 1,001 reasons why not, and only about 1.5 reasons why there should be anything. So, this is not actually going to be a kind of utopia is impossible talk, but I would be suggesting that we need to go a long way before we get there. I hope this doesn't come up too much like a lecture, but I did this, I'm saying to some members of the audience here, study utopian socialism when I was doing my PhD a long time ago, and so I can't see that we can talk about modern utopian ideas without looking back at some of the past ideas. And the utopian socialist were in particular criticised by Marx, and I think those criticisms will be of interest to you, probably. And I could start in a more abstract way. The meaning of utopia was, the world was created by Thomas More. So Thomas More, who was the Chancellor of Henry VIII and eventually got executed because he disagreed with Henry VIII about Henry's divorce and that sort of thing. Thomas More wrote a book called Utopia in 1516, and the title, because he was a very learned man, was a kind of pun on Greek words meaning no place and good place. So a utopia is a good place which is also nowhere at all. It's an impossible place, if you like. It's that latter sense that we dwell on in the media, in general communication these days. Oh, that's a utopian idea, i.e. that's rubbish, that's an impossible idea. But there have been many serious attempts to show, by means of constructing or devising places that don't exist, to show the way in which the world could go, and that's the, as I see it, the twofold purpose of utopian writing is to say what's wrong with the world as it is and to say in what ways it could be changed to make it a better world, which is actually exactly what Thomas More did, because part one of his book, Utopia, which is a very small book if you fancy a short read, part one was a really devastating critique of the land laws, of the court system of Henry VIII's time, and the kind of laws, the cruel punishments that were inflicted on people. It's really shocking, scandalous criticism of the way society was then. Part two is about an imaginary society where all these evils have been eradicated. So there are lots of kinds of utopias. A friend of mine, an academic colleague, has written a bibliography of kind of utopias which runs to tens of thousands. There are so many books, if we include science fiction, of course there's a vast range of imaginary societies in the world of science fiction. Some of you may know those much better than I do. There are several things that utopias can, how a utopian works, either of fiction or of political trap kind of works. How can they work? They can glorify the past. That's one way of saying the present is so much worse than the past was. Look back to a golden age. That's something which some kinds of utopias do. They can predict an ideal future, the sort of thing that H.G. Wells was rather good at. He also predicted very horrible futures, so he wrote utopias and dystopias. Another way of proceeding by the person who wants to get his or her ideas across through a fictional means is to turn the present upside down. So there have been utopias where the world is ruled by women, not by men, or of course a lot of utopias have no private property, and that's turning the world upside down, if anything ever is. So a kind of inversion of the present is another way of making a political point. Think how the world could be if it were, if women ruled, not men, that sort of thing. More generally, utopias tend to envisage a world elsewhere, where things are much more ideal than in present society, and to use those stories of journeys to the world elsewhere to report back to the author's own society and say, look, this is how the world could be. So there are various ways of writing possible political futures, which also serve to cast a light on the unsatisfactory political and social and economic present. I'm not going to dwell on whether utopia is a perfect society or a better society or the best society. We could argue about that. People do for a long time. I think the thing to bear in mind is utopias, good utopias, whether it's a political tract or a fiction or a film or a drama even, it subverts reality, it subverts the existing state of things. Another word often used in connection with utopias is they transgress the norms and the paradigms of the present, the ideals that we may, or values we hold, they kind of overturn those, they transgress those boundaries that limit our thought at the moment. So I want to say something about Thomas More and about the three central utopians, socialists, and about why Marx criticised them, hopefully not for too greater length. Thomas More is, as I say, the author of the book called Utopia, 1516. That very typical story where some voyagers go to a faraway land that hasn't yet made it onto the maps. They're possibly the first European explorers. They find a society very much like Britain of the time or England of the time, which is wholly egalitarian. It's divided equally into 54 cities, which are all exactly the same size with the same number of populations, a bit regimented, you might say. Private property has been abolished. People live communally, they eat communally, they work communally, they draw what they need, supplies from the communal stores. Everyone labours on the land, I think it's for 6 months every 2 years, I might have some of these details, and the rest of the time they can pursue their other activities, being cobblers or farriers or craftspeople or weavers. People wear all wear the same clothes exactly. Decoration is not permitted because that would allow people to start distinguishing themselves, comparing themselves with others. It would get away from the egalitarian ethic, and basically there's a strong focus on work but also on play in the evenings, where they attend lectures rather like these for pleasure, believe it or not, and play educating games or educative games. One theme I find rather interesting in these utopias, most of which were written by educated people, most of which by men until quite a rarity until the 20th century to find women's writing utopias. Of course, there's the idea that it's good for everyone to work, and given that these are all intellectuals who probably never did any manual work in their lives, and I would certainly put Thomas More in that bracket, there's a kind of top-down view of what life ought like to be like. But of course, at least everyone has work in Moore's utopia. And if you think, if you read the first part of his book and know anything about what the life of the peasantry might have been like in 1516, although it sounds a rather harsh and regimented life, they would have, in Thomas More's ideal world, those who were poor in his own society would have had full bellies, they'd have had employment, they would have had education, and all the things that basically the lower orders, as he probably thought of, he just didn't have. So he's abolished property and he's abolished poverty. The book was very influential. There were lots of subsequent books written of kind of answering more or elaborating the same sort of ideas. But I want to mention at the latter part of the 18th century, the 1790s onwards, the three utopian socialists whose names are at the top three on that board, in case you're not familiar with them. First two are French, Saint-Simon and Fourier. I want to say a bit about what they, how they presented an ideal, a socialist future. They didn't generally think of themselves as socialists. The word was barely invented at the time. They talked about cooperation, which of course had been a very strong theme of socialist, the socialist movement. They talked about association, which is similar to cooperation. The idea was really that in a capitalist society, cooperation is enforced. The workers might cooperate in the factory or on the production line, but that's enforced cooperation for the profit of the employer. These three utopian socialists were thinking of cooperation as something voluntarily, willingly undertaken for the well-being of everyone, not for the well-being of an employer, of a capitalist. So let's have a look about... If you want to ask a question at any time, just yes, tell me to shut up and ask what stop me. Saint-Simon is not what we think of as a socialist these days. He envisaged a kind of alliance between the workers and the bosses, which is, as I say, not what we think of as socialist these days. He thought that kind of the capitalist system could be turned into a wonderfully productive system that would provide an abundance for all if there were no more conflict between capital and labour. And he envisaged the overthrow of the old order, because, of course, this is in the middle of the French Revolutionary period in the 1790s. The overthrow of the old order and the creation of a new parliament, which would be run by artists, scientists and industrialists, all working in harmony. He thought what he calls this industrial system would bring about peace and tranquility, and that's... might surprise you to think or to know that quite a lot of people have argued that of capitalism, that because commerce requires trust. Don't laugh at all this, but if you follow the reason, commerce requires trust with the person you're about to do a transaction with, and trust widespread brings about harmony or peace, because we can't do trade with people who we're at war with or people we don't trust. So that's an idea that you find in Saint-Simon. He also had a theory of history rather similar to that of Marx, but of course he's writing some decades before Marx, that history was moving forward in cycles, that there came times of conflict and then... history moved to a higher plane, as it were, and the final plane would be a socialist plane. So in a way it's very similar to Marx's idea. Tell me, by the way, how I think I'm about halfway through.
Okay.
Robert Owen is a homegrown utopian who put into practice some of his ideas for the betterment of the working classes. He was a manufacturer, I think first of all in Manchester. Then he moved to a place called New Lanark, which is near Old Lanark in Scotland, and set up a factory there. He built an ideal village for his workers, which you can visit. It's a World Heritage Site these days, and very attractive buildings. And he produced a school for the children. He had for bad public houses and drunkenness. The workers were given sort of encouragement of all kinds to do their shifts. The children weren't sent into the factories. It was a textile factory. The children weren't made to work in the factories at terribly young ages. And generally it was a sort of ideal system. Except he was still the boss. He got the profits from this rather model village, this village factory village, which attracted all sorts of attention all over Europe. The Tsar of Russia came to see it because it was thought to be a new ideal way forward of organising a manufacturing industry. And Owen then wrote a lot of tracts, not fictions, but tracts about, which he sent to the government, sort of plans for the reform of the working classes. He draws up schemes for village communities, as much like New Lanark was, but on a kind of a grander scale, where people live communally, they share houses, they eat communally, the children are all educated, there's healthy work in the fields to support the village, and there's a manufactory, as they called them in those days, in part of this community. So he called these villages of cooperation. Again, the emphasis is on voluntary cooperation, not the enforced cooperation. Robert Owen also attacked private property, obviously, because of this sort of communalisation. He also attacked religion and marriage. He thought marriage was another aspect of the possessiveness which underlies capitalism. Religion, he thought, was a load of superstition which should be outlawed. Fourier and Robert Owen, of course, did have quite a lot of influence. A number of colonies or communities were set up in America based on his principles. They tended to go wrong because of internal disagreements, or because people who put the capital in to build the colony tended to want a profit out of their capital, contributions. So things went wrong in a number of ways. Some of the communities, on the other hand, Owenite communities lasted quite a long time. Fourier, much madder than the rest, far more fun to read. Another idea of small communities based on communal possessions, sharing of everything, including sexual favours. He had some strong views about how the sexually gifted should share their favours with other people so that everyone had a satisfactory amount. Fourier is mainly about, his work is mainly about attractive labour. He thought if everyone could be given the sort of work that suited their passion, their passions, their kind of emotive, and their character, then the world would be a happy place. And he envisages those who love roses being in the rose-growing team, and those who like cooking pastry would be in the pastry cook's team, and it would all work together in a wonderful scheme which he calls harmony. He is a bit of a fantasist. Even so, there were communities set up in the 1840s in Switzerland, the Jura, which is part of France, plus Switzerland, that were based on his principles. So in the utopian, it's important really, in the utopian socialists, in this troika of utopian socialists, they all had followers who all went off and set up communities in their name. Probably the most successful were the Saint-Simonians, who, because of Saint-Simon's kind of industrial idea. They got into great infrastructural projects, and some of them were involved in the building of the Panama Canal and roads and bridges and canals elsewhere, that sort of thing. They saw Saint-Simon as leading not to what we think of as socialism, but to vast projects for the domination, the overcoming of the mastery of nature, for the good of human beings. That was one of the themes of Saint-Simon. Workers and bosses will have an identity of interests. They'll all cooperate to overcome, to master nature. It's not a very green message, but things have moved on since then. So what Marx said about the utopian socialists, and he mentions them a bit in the Communist Manifesto, and Engels has more on them in a book called Socialism, Utopian and Scientific. I think that's the title. Well, Marx obviously was on their side in the sense of abolition of private property, collective ways of life, overthrow of capitalism. But he thought, because these three were all writing at the very, almost before industrialism had started in France, in France in 1790s, 1810s and 20s, they were still working in large workshops, ateliers sort of thing. They hadn't got these vast factories that we had in Britain. So he thought these three socialists hadn't quite realised that the interests of capital and of labour are inexorably opposed. They thought that somehow you could fuse the interests of capital and labour, perhaps by abolishing capital, perhaps by, like Saint-Simon, showing the workers and the bosses that their interests were identical. It's in everyone's interest to have prosperous industry. So Marx thought these guys imagined they could dissolve the class struggle instead of realising that it was inevitable that the class struggle should continue until capitalism had been overthrown. He also, Engels in particular, argued that they thought, these three men thought, they could overcome the problems of capitalism by appeal to reason. And of course, it was action that Marx and Engels wanted. What Marx said about Feuerbach, philosophers have thought about the world.
Have only interpreted the world in
the
various
point,
ways.
The point, however, is to change it. Yes, thank you. That's exactly it. So these utopians are a bit like philosophers. They're thinking about the world. They're applying reason, but they're not changing it. And Marx's other point was, and probably this was the one that most vexed him about them, is he thought they were draining away the energies of the working classes and what should be put into a more direct confrontation and realisation of one's class position into proletarian self-consciousness. They were being drained away into the co-op movement. Owen was very big in that. Mechanics institutes for the education of artisans. Owen was quite instrumental in that. So you're kind of, they were diversionary, if you like. Utopian socialism was diversionary. Marx also didn't believe in blueprints for the future, which, in a sense, all three of them gave. He thought history is obviously moving on to its higher phase, but we can't draw up a blueprint, and he didn't do that himself. I mentioned, but not in detail at all, three other people. In the late 19th century, Edward Bellamy wrote a book called Looking Backwards, where, note the date, 1888, the dreamer wakes up in 2003, and goodness, it's all been transformed into a very industrial, America's become a very industrial society, but it's all owned by the state, because corporations have got bigger and bigger, and become monopolies. Eventually the state has taken them over and runs it. So I suppose you'd call it a state capitalist society with industrial, no private property, industrial armies, men and women work separately, all doing their task, all well rewarded. And everyone retires at 45, which sounds quite utopian, doesn't it? In answer to which, William Morris, back in England, who of course was the man who designed all that wonderful wallpaper and lovely materials, and lived an arts and crafts sort of life, William Morris writes an answer to Bellamy in a book called News from Nowhere, which is a sort of rustic, Britain is a rustic paradise with artisans living in the countryside, joining in the everyone joins in the harvest, no private property. The Houses of Parliament turned into a dung store, a store for manure, and generally a pretty anarchic kind of organisation. William Morris was quite a medievalist and looks back to some aspects of even pre-Norman Britain, where there are kind of moots for debating issues of social interest, general communal interest, but there's no antagonism, no real politics. Those are H.G. Wells, who wrote quite a lot, as I've mentioned, a lot of dystopias, several utopias, and he was, of course, a socialist in the early part of the 20th century. He's very interested in the confrontation between capital and labour, and as this book, which I'm going to mention to you, says, capital and labour, in the time machine, that remote bit of the time machine, the descendants of capital and labour are still in conflict. And, so H.G. Wells envisages various socialist futures and various dystopian futures. There's a long string of utopian thought. In the 1960s and 70s, feminist utopias were written. Since then, a lot of green utopias have been written, which to some extent both of these genres, if you like, share interest with socialist utopias, but don't absolutely coincide. There are two ways of looking at the future, then. Is utopia possible? One, given my original point, that a utopian future, utopian possibilities somehow subvert or transgress or overturn existing matters. These two ways of looking at the future generally fall into the types of egalitarian futures where things are much more equal. And now, usually because private property, i.e. capital and labour, have been abolished. And elitist futures where a few very smart people run the rest and run the show, and the rest of us being necessarily inferior, put in our places and basically governed by benign dictators. That's a kind of strain of thought that comes from Plato's work in The Republic, and you can find that in H.G. Wells. In a way I see it as a political philosopher. You've got the elitist utopians thinking there are two kinds of people, the smart ones and the not so smart ones. Let's have the smart ones run the show in the light of reason and benevolence, and the egalitarians, which I'm sure most of you probably would side with, who think, you know, there is virtue in everyone. If in the right sort of cooperative society, this can be brought out. Everyone can have opportunities to fulfil themselves through work and other activities, and no one has a kind of elite right to rule. So some of the questions we might be thinking about is if you were designing society from a blank sheet, as these utopian thinkers did. Never a blank sheet, because you're always living in the present, so you've got to make yourself a blank sheet. But if you were designing it from a blank sheet, would you go for an egalitarian model, or would you go for a more elitist model, the rule of the wise or the rule of everybody kind of question? It's one of the things we might ask. As to my own position, while sort of old Labourish, I don't know that I would want to live in any utopia that has ever yet been designed. This is a problem, because ultimately it's a rather personal thing, so we might each have slightly different utopias in our heads. And a great part of the 20th, a great amount of print was spilt, or ink was spilt, in the second half of the 20th century by people like Karl Popper, Hayek, the Austrian economist. Arguing that utopianism was it was inevitably authoritarian, because it consisted of one person trying to impose his or her views on others. So that's a part of another story, that utopians really are fanatics who want to oppress everyone else, make them conform to the fanatic's own view of how society should be. So I think we have anyone who favours the aspirational effect of utopian thinking has also to contend against that finger pointing, you're an authoritarian, because you want people to fall into your way of living, has to contend against that. Okay, I didn't go on much too long.
Okay.
Right, thank you. I think that there will, in the first part of my talk, be a certain amount of overlap, because my particular starting point is with the utopian socialists. Well, that's fair enough, and I bow to your superior knowledge of detail on the particular individuals, but I will say something about them, and some of it does overlap with what you've said. Before coming to the interesting questions that you were raising at the end of your talk, which ties in nicely to what I shall be wanting to say about what we consider to be the practical proposition of socialism. So I'm beginning where Barbara began, with the utopian socialists, and I was going to ask, why were they so called? But I think that's been well answered, in fact. And why the socialism associated with Karl Marx was given the scientific label. The utopian socialists then were, as written on the board, St. Simon, Robert Owen and Fourier. And this was a time when socialism was... wouldn't it be nice? No, if capitalism was taking off... but was still not fully developed. We're talking about the turn of the 18th century. The early utopian and cooperative ideas were a reaction to the rapidly developing factory system, and their ideas were, we consider, more from a moral standpoint. Their views have sometimes been summed up as considering that the right of the labourer to the full produce of their labour. They criticised society but couldn't necessarily see the exploitation or the exact form it took. Didn't yet see the workers as a class, because the working class in the modern sense was not fully developed. St. Simon, a French aristocrat, was concerned with the welfare of the poor, but said that the problem of social organisation had to be solved for people, that they were powerless, passive and listless. He could see the tremendous potential in the changes that were taking place, but wanted society organised in a manner to be advantageous to the largest number. He wanted a capitalism that had become altruistic. The aristocracy of the future was to be based not on privilege, but on ability. It would consist of the industrial bourgeois and the technicians. His followers had the saying of from each according to capacity to each according to work. And Robert Owen was also well mentioned. And the term socialist, in fact, first appeared in an Owenite magazine, and it was a synonym for cooperative. That was in 1827. And then there's the famous time at New Lanark, when he observed the enormous increase in the production of wealth that had taken place. He said that the working part of a population of 2,500 persons were daily producing as much real wealth as less than 50 years before it would have required the working part of 600,000 to create. And he observed the gross irrationality of the system, inflicting misery on the producing classes while such enormously superabundant means to produce wealth and happiness for all and are at the control of society, but utterly neglected. Now, he thought that what he saw about the conditions and the potential would be, everyone else would be pleased to see it. But he was disappointed by the reaction of the government. He had a plan for dealing with the unemployed instead of poor relief. And in a report to the Committee for the Relief of the Manufacturing Poor, he said the government should raise funds to establish village settlements with 1,200 inhabitants and land to produce food, mixture of agriculture and manufacture. It would, in fact, have cost £100,000 to set up one of these villages, so you can sort of understand that the government was not in the least bit anxious to do this. He was also disappointed by the reaction of the manufacturers in the House of Commons to his bill for regulating the employment of young children. It took some years to be passed and was virtually useless when it was passed, and he was disgusted by the delays and left it to other people to work on it. I think the children and working in wool, flax and silk were removed from the bill, and working in flax mills was particularly obnoxious. But he opposed the idea of the Chartist idea of manhood suffrage. He said it was a bauble that would be bring neither good nor evil. He thought that the rich must always govern, and also asked the workers to abandon their class hate. Now, Engels, on the Utopian Socialist, said that to crude conditions of capitalist production and crude class divisions had corresponded crude theories. The more completely worked out in detail, the more they couldn't avoid drifting off into fantasies. And he might have had Fourier in mind, who gave minute details of how industry and agriculture, etc., should be carried out in his phalanxes, each with 1,600 souls. And he apportioned work on the basis of ability, and as Barbara said, so work should be pleasurable. And then his famous view that the children who liked making dirt pies and getting into a mess, that they would do the dirty work. And he had some elaborate division of wealth between labour, capital and talent. So the Utopian Socialists then were considering problems when capitalism is underdeveloped, trying to make life better for people, but with designs for the whole population. And as I said, thought their reasonable suggestions would be taken up by the rich and powerful. And St. Simon apparently had hopes of Napoleon I. And they were opposing exploitation without fully understanding. However, elements in their ideas were looking forward, and Marx considered that they were revolutionary in their day, but their followers were still sticking to the ideas that they had, even when there'd been progress in the development of the proletariat. He said they became mere reactionary sects. So we come to scientific socialism. Now, Marx claimed that he never used the term of scientific socialism, except in contrast to utopian socialism, such as that and he said of Bakunin and Proudhon, because at the time he was answering a criticism of Bakunin. He says, which put unrealistic fantasies into people's heads instead of limiting itself to the science which recognises the self-produced social movement of the people. So what did he mean by socialism and communism? Well, first, what did he mean by capitalism? And that was a relationship between wage labour and capital. The capitalist class owning the means of production and not needing to work, and the propertyless proletariat, or working class, having to sell its labour power in return for wages. Now, I said about the utopian socialists and this idea of the right of the labourer to the full produce of labour, and someone like J.F. Bray in his Labour's Wrongs and Remedies said that it would be less taxes required for the functioning of government. But Marx worked out that it wasn't the labour that the worker sold to the employer, but the ability to work. In fact, the labour power. And he was then able to explain surplus value. Workers being paid for the value of their labour power, but only part of the working time being necessary to replace the value of their wages. The rest of the time produces surplus value to the benefit of the employer. In fact, because it's a social process, the working class does all of the jobs necessary to the system, not just the ones actually producing things, and as a class produce surplus value. And it's the capitalist as a class that exploits workers and extracts surplus value. There's social production, but private ownership of the means of production, and a conflict of interest between the classes. The quest for profit is the driving force of the system, and it rapidly increased the ability to produce, as Owen noted in his Mill, but also prevents the satisfaction of human need in different ways. Doesn't care about the environment or whether people go hungry. There still is tremendous potential, but the progress is perverted. The solution, as we say, is for the abolition of capitalism and therefore the abolition of the wages system, of buying and selling, for common ownership of the means of production in a classless, stateless world. In other words, what Marx meant by socialism. Plainly not the situation in China, nor what was had in the Soviet Union. So I come to what we mean by socialism, which is given some definition of, but it's a fundamental change, a complete transformation of the way production and distribution are organised, an end to capitalism, an end to wage labour and capital. Instead, that there be common ownership and democratic control of the whole means of production by and on behalf of the whole worldwide community. When the means of production are owned in common, so also is the products. There are no owners or no non-owners, no governments, no role for money, no longer production of sale and profit, but production solely for use with free access to what is required. And here I must mention what we mean by equality. It means that everyone has the same relationship to the means of production. Common ownership means everyone owns it in common. Everyone has the same relationship. There aren't any owners or non-owners. The sole aim of production is the satisfaction of human need, which also means care of the environment, because it's absolutely vital to human interests. Such a change can't happen without the understanding and the participation of the great or the necessary majority, those who belong to the class which now do all of the work, consciously taking political action to abolish capitalism and end class rule. Not a matter of waiting for results to be declared and then decide, what are we going to do here? But working out how to organise the how things are going to be done would be happening as the ideas blossom. People preparing to implement the necessary changes in every sphere, looking at their work and deciding what should continue and what shouldn't. We have, of course, to start from where we are. We have to assume things are much as they are now. It's likely that a growing movement would have influence on the events in advance of getting the necessary majority. Now, the small number of socialists in this country do not have to produce a plan for the whole world, and like Marx, we don't think that we should make blueprints for the future. That would be a fantasy. That would be utopian if we were to say that this is exactly how you're going to do everything. But what we can do is give the basis of what common ownership and democratic control means, examples of what could be done. And it's always easier to start with what won't happen. As I said, there won't be any role for money. Therefore, likewise, all the institutions associated with money, banks, insurance, all the financial aspects of production will go. I mean, years ago, we used to give the example of ticket collectors. You know, we wouldn't need ticket collectors anymore. Well, now they don't have ticket collectors, but very elaborate machinery to control who's paying fares, who's not, and security and so on. Well, all that can go. There are problems about energy supplies. Well, what we can say is that there will be different requirements, different transport needs, for example. For example, many thousands now travel into cities to work in banking and insurance, and I think a third of all workers in inner London are so employed. And the debate's going on about airport capacity, and they are concerned with competing with other airports in Europe, you know, for passengers. Well, it's not the most rational way for human beings to organise things. And, of course, there's the duplicate journeys made by goods. There's a tremendous waste of human labour and resources. The annual military expenditure worldwide is $1.6 trillion. So more people would be available for useful work. We think of unemployment now and how the problem is presented. Oh, my goodness, how to find jobs to produce goods in competition with other people in other places producing goods. But it would be more rational, more sensible for human beings to look instead at what is actually needed. And we would probably need to spend less time working, but in any case, work would be rather different to employment. Human beings need to work, need to be creative, be doing things. Some needs would be different, but the way things are done would be developed from how problems are solved, for example, clearing up the mess left by capitalism. There will not be government, but administration, of course. There has to be organisation. Decisions about production, resources and the environment. And modern technology, of which I have no great understanding, I have to say, will, I'm told, be a useful tool in democratic decision-making. And we could adapt useful parts of the present system. Even some government departments have useful aspects to them. And there are various worldwide organisations, UN bodies like the Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Health Organization, freed from money considerations of profit and cost, and national rivalries could perform a useful role, at least in the early days. Socialism, of course, needs abundance or ample sufficiency so that there is an assured free access. But even capitalism has proved capable of greatly increasing food supplies and the doubled over 50 years and would have kept pace with the growth of population. But, of course, food isn't grown now to feed people. Of course, it is in a certain sense, otherwise it wouldn't be grown at all, but that's not its object, is to be sold at a profit. The Food and Agriculture Organization considers that globally there's enough land, soil, water, and the potential for increased yields to make the necessary increase in production for the prospective population increase feasible, but it depends on the policy environment. Crucially, they expect the effective market demand to be met, but millions who lack money or resources will still go hungry. It should point out that, well, you're probably all familiar with 1 billion people now undernourished, but also in this great country that we've been hearing about during their elections, there's 35 million households in the United States that have food insecurity, as it is called, and a similar number of people in households in Europe. A world of common ownership could properly feed all of its inhabitants. It would mean food grown and processed simply to be eaten. We'll be able to use sustainable methods with food grown locally as far as possible. We won't do these things like, you know, sending prawns from Scotland to China for shelling. It's just sort of nonsense. Be able to make the best use of land, and I query the need to have giant greenhouses, as there are now in Thanet, that are on good agricultural land, but growing salad crops all the year round. Here again, we have to be careful about sounding as though all problems can, you know, just be solved. But what we are saying is that common ownership and production solely for use will provide the framework for solving problems, will provide the best framework for dealing with the challenges, for example, of climate change. The Food and Agriculture Organization sees the perspective for food security problems coming from climate variation rather than progressive climate change, developed countries being, of course, better able to mitigate and adapt to adverse climate events. In the period towards 2015-2030, they see the basic food issue will remain that of poverty and the lack of food purchasing power. As I said, socialism will provide the framework for dealing with these problems. In fact, in many cases, it will mean applying solutions that are already known. Within capitalism, of course, all the solutions are in terms of cost and profit. The United Nations Environment Programme, I think it is, in 2010, said that restoring lost and damaged ecosystems can trigger multi-million dollar returns. And that's in something, advertising something, the dead planet, living planet. And there are numerous reports, in fact, you know, people must make their living from these reports, but looking at what things ought to be done on water, and one in Stockholm, I think, at the end of last year, and saying that there ought to be cooperation and so on. But say it, the kind of cooperation that they say there ought to be could only happen in a world of common ownership and production solely for use. Right. To get such a change in the world needs active cooperation of the majority, the conscious understanding of the need for change and how to do it. We put forward socialism as a practical proposition, not claiming it to be an ideal state, not setting out all the details, but putting it forward as the best way to resolve the problems inherent in the capitalist system. It's not a utopian fantasy, but a practical proposition made possible by an understanding of the capitalist system and of its useful but outgrown place in history. Mm-hmm.